Accession number 20591, Reel 1.
This is Norman Mitchell, tape 1. So, can you remember your national service number?
My army number is 143161 53.
Well remembered. Never. So tell me about where you were born and your date of birth.
My date of birth is the 23rd of March 1924, and that was in Bristol.
And what did your parents do?
My father was worked in the distillers company yeast factory in the Bristol production, on the production side. Mother wouldn't work. Mothers didn't work in those days.
So, did you have brothers and sisters?
I had six brothers and sisters, one of which died at birth. But so, to all intents and purposes, there were six of us. Yeah.
Where did you come in the family?
I was third in line.
Uh-huh. Right. And where did you go to school?
I went initially to Upper Horfield Junior School. I then passed 11 plus and went to what was then Fairfield Secondary School. This is now Fairfield Grammar School. It's been upgraded since.
And when did you leave?
I left there in 1940 and went then to... I had a direct entry with the matric examination, which I passed. I had direct entry then into Bristol University, the agricultural department, studying agricultural chemistry. And I stayed there for 2 years until I was called up on the 15th of October, 1942.
What sports and things did you, or hobbies did you have before you,
I played rugby and cricket. In those younger days, mm-hmm. Later in life, I played cricket quite seriously, and then I played golf for many years. But that's retired from that now.
So, I mean, you knew you were going to be called up, didn't you? What did you feel about that?
I think one realised that it was inevitable, that it would happen. And therefore, when it came, I suppose, a certain amount of relief. It was caused my mother a lot of problems, because my elder brother, Horace, was missing, presumed killed in the Air Force in 1941. He was 4 years older than I am. So you can imagine that there was a little bit of uproar when the second son, because it was my the sister between, and my the second son, was on his way as well.
So what did your father say?
Well, my father said to me, I wish I was coming with you. But he said, don't take any note of this old rubbish that you get told about. You'll go out and fight for freedom and come back to a land fit for heroes to live in. He said, I was told that, and look where it landed me. Controversial, I expect, that. And that was it. And I then journeyed then to Bury St. Edmunds in Suffolk.
Do you remember that journey?
I do. A bit trying by rail. I had to walk in those days from where we lived in Bristol. I had to walk for about 2.5 miles to a bus stop, to catch a bus to Temple Mead Station in Bristol, and then across London and up to Suffolk. And I was late getting there. I do remember that.
So which was where were you actually reporting to?
Bury St. Edmunds, the Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire Light Infantry Depot. At West Lines, Bury St. Edmunds.
Did you meet other people in the train you were going?
No. No. Right.
So what was it like, sort of, you walked up to the camp, did you?
Well, I was already in... I forgot to tell you that I was already in the Home Guard anyway. So when you were called up in those days, you wore the Home Guard uniform. You wore that. So, I mean, I can't remember meeting anybody, but having arrived late there was a bonus, because instead of me being put in with a load of other they were formed in platoons for training, instead of me putting in with a load of other 18-year-olds, I didn't. I was put into a platoon which consisted of policemen, ex-policemen that had just been called up in their early 20s. Now, the result of that was that the army instructors of that wouldn't push them about quite so much as they would the young. So I was rather fortunate.
Yeah. So what was it like, you know, arriving there? I mean, you've got a little bit of sort of military experience.
Well, the first night was... the first night we spent slept on bare boards because they weren't ready for us and there were no beds available. And so we just had an army blanket and laid on the floor fully dressed. Quite an education. But gradually it improved. And we were trained by some regular NCOs. One of them I do remember was Sergeant Robert Hex, a Gloucestershire regiment. Very proud of his regiment he was too. One of the only regiments in the army that's allowed to wear a badge back and front. Brass in front and brass behind, never feared a foe of any kind, he used to tell us. He's quite a pleasant sort of guy.
Yeah. Let me keep you back just at the beginning of the moment. I mean, had you an idea of what the war was going to be like for you?
Not really. No. I knew I'd have to be trained as an infantryman to start with. And that was what the first 6 weeks consisted of. Square bashing, rifle drill, Bren gun drill, camouflage and all that sort of thing. And
so did you know what your life was going to be like, though? What war was going to be like? Did you have any idea?
Only from films that you saw. And, I mean, they were... you look at them now and you see the films they show of action and you think, well, what a load of old rubbish. It's never like that. I mean, the first thing you see in a film is people in infantry advancing along a skyline. Well, that's the last thing you do.
Yeah. Right. So, did you choose your unit?
No.
So, the first night you spent on the bare boards, what happened after that?
Well, then things got a little bit better. The food was not too bad. It wasn't like home, of course, but one gradually got accustomed to it.
And so that next day, did they assume you
were... We were beds uniform? Gradually, and we had other uniform and the old denim for, you know, work, that sort of thing. And
the rest of your kit?
The rest of the kit, yes. Yeah.
So what was the food like then?
In actual fact, it wasn't too bad. I can't say that it was enjoyable, but it was adequate. I think that's the best way to describe it, just being adequate, you know. Mm-hmm. It was enough.
Yeah. So they gave you your kit, and I suppose they told you how to look after it.
Oh, yes, you were told how to look after it, and how to keep it clean, and how to polish the brasses, and all those sort of things. And
Did they start off kit inspections straight away?
After... A first fortnight, because we obviously one had to be integrated into what the training and so on and so forth, and we had, I should think, about a fortnight before the first kit inspection was held, and then of course this was demonstrated by our corporal and the lance corporal, who are also regular bods, you know, on how to lay everything out and so on.
And how was that for you? I mean, was it difficult or tense?
It wasn't enjoyable, no.
So when the door opened and the inspection came in.
The inspecting officer came in, there was always a certain amount of apprehension that something would be wrong, someone would be folded wrong, you know. Socks had to be folded in a particular way, you know, and if you didn't do that, well, they were flicked off the bed, and then you'd have to redo them right there and then.
What were your sort of initial reactions to army lifestyle? You know, different from being at home?
Well, yeah. I don't think I was... I didn't revolt against it. It had to be done. I think one accepted that it was necessary. And therefore one just went along with it, you know.
So the other people in your billet, that was the
whole platoon, that consisted mainly of police officers, but there was one... one very, very salubrious gentleman there, whose name I forget, he was a manager of in the Swiss bank. Very pleasant character.
So that sounds quite a sort of civilised sort of atmosphere.
It was a very civilised platoon, but you get some of the other platoons when they were all 18-year-olds, and believe you me, I wouldn't want to have been in them. One could see what was going on.
What sort of things would be going on?
Oh, bullying and, criticising people in front of the whole, getting the fellow out and criticising one thing and another.
But you didn't experience
We didn't, with our old sergeant, as I say, old Lance Sergeant, latest Lance Sergeant, Lance Art Brown, he, the old Gloucestershire one, is very good, very nice guy. And, I mean, let's be honest, I think he realised that policemen had been around a bit and had had a bit of discipline, and therefore he didn't have to be quite so bloody, perhaps, as some of the others, you know. Yeah.
So what was your accommodation like once you were settled?
Oh, just an ordinary wooden hut.
Reasonably comfortable?
Reasonably comfortable, yeah. We had the old stove in there, you know, the old, whatever they call them, I forget what they call them there. The old stove for which we used to have rations of coal and timber and that sort of thing. And then we used to acquire our own timber from various places to keep it going.
Did you have to do guard duty?
Yes.
What was that like? Tell me about that.
Well... You didn't do this for the first 3 weeks because, you know, I in actual fact had done rifle drill anyway. I could manage that. But some of the others, of course, hadn't. Even the policemen hadn't had rifle drill in it. So until you were well versed in rifle drill, you couldn't go on guard. Because if you had a rifle and the officer came in, you had slope arms and salute and present arms if he was a major or above. But then you had to get to know the officers on the camp. It's a bit of a bit of guesswork if it was somebody coming in from another unit. But so I suppose I don't do any guard on there for about 3 weeks. Then it worked out at about once every 10 days. You know, used to be on night guard. Yeah.
And what was that like?
Boring. Nothing to do. Sit around. Go out and do your stag. You know what your stag is when you're actually out there. The rest of the time spent in the guard room, you know.
What would you do in the guard room?
Oh, talk. Probably have a game of cards. If there was a set of cards about, you should play rummy, whist, playing things like that.
Did you dread doing guard duty?
I had no great feeling against it. It was a necessity.
So, while you were in initial training, I mean, did you get a chance for sort of recreation or sport?
No. No, there was no... There was... obviously, physical training, yeah. Oh, plenty of that, yeah.
Did you have any contact with civilians in the area?
Very little. Very little. There was, in actual fact, a canteen at the building called the Athenaeum in Bury St Edmunds. It's very good, where one could go. You weren't allowed out of camp for the first fortnight, I believe it was, but when you could then walk into town, which is quite nearby, and that was what we used to do, just go into the canteen, perhaps have coffee and whatever was going, and then back home again.
So, a general absence of female company, or did people find girls?
Weren't bothered in those days, although I was 18. it's funny to say that now. Mm.
So, were some of the older policemen, were some of them married?
Some of the majority of them were married anyway, yeah. Yeah. Oh, they were from various police forces. There's one from Devonshire. There are two or three from the Devon police force. One from Hertfordshire, old Fred Betts, who I remember quite well, who took me under his wing, being a young, I'll look after you, which was rather pleasant. Yeah.
Did you understand what was sort of actually going on in the war then? You know, did you see films or movies?
No, they had what they call the ABCA sessions, ABC of the war, when at least once a week you would have these sessions of about three quarters of an hour, when somebody from the office, one of the officers, would come in and point out what was happening around the world. So we were kept in touch with what was going on, yeah.
Can you remember any of the actions that were going on while you were in initial training?
1942, of course, there was the big push across North Africa, wasn't there? Wavell's 20,000, yeah, was it 20,000 or 30,000 he had? Wipe the Italians off the face of the earth until the Germans arrived. Mm. And then you have to come back. Mm. And then you get the to and fro of all the various axes in North Africa until eventually you got our dear friend Monty came in with all his arrogance.
How did you view Montgomery then?
I think we regarded him as a very good commander. And the reason for that, I think, perhaps not in the early days, because, I mean, he was nothing to do with us. He only came on the scene as GOC Southeastern Command, I believe. And it's difficult to say in the early stages. We only met him once when he came down to inspect all the forces, and that was could have been early 1944, and that was down in, I think it was in Maidstone in Kent, when he came down and inspected, and then his usual thing whereby he drove his Land Rover, his Range Rover, whatever it was, into the, and beckoned everybody in to come, and then his usual pep, his pep talk.
So did he stand out from the others?
Oh yes, he did. He certainly did. Yeah, well, he was looked up. Mind his reputation, I think, helped. Although people like myself who knew a little bit about history, I mean, it was the fact that he was only put in command of the 8th Army because of a casualty. The guy that was going out there was the old General Gott, whose aircraft was lost on his way out, I think. Yeah.
So, tell me about the basic drill training and so on. How difficult was that?
Well, having done quite a bit of it in the Home Guard, you see, I'd been in the Home Guard for about a year, so, I mean, I knew the square bashing and things like that. So they obviously, you know, one or two things wanted to smarten up with and all get together. But it didn't come as anything strange to me, you know, having done it before, you see.
How did the instructors treat you? Were they as abusive or shouting?
Well, not with us. With this platoon I was with, as I say, we were very fortunate.
Did you do the light infantry pace?
No. No.
So, what about fitness? I mean, they had to get you fit, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was your physical training. You were on that most days. You went down for...
What did you do in that?
Running on the spot was a great one. No one did, arms flinging and bending and twisting and one thing another. And jumping over the horse, you know, the horses and that sort of thing, and wall bars and ropes and things like that.
Did you do route marches?
Not until the last week of training. Then we went out on marches then, yeah.
And how far were they?
Well, more than about 3 or 4 miles, perhaps, yeah.
And did you do any boxing?
No.
Right, okay. So, weapons training.
Yep.
Presume they taught you about the rifle first.
Oh yes, the Lee Enfield as it was at the time, yeah.
And what did they teach you? I mean, they taught you how to look after it.
How to look after it, yes. So, after firing, it needed to be cleaned out with the old 4x2. You want 4x2, is it? Yeah, you know about this. And yeah, of course, the calamity was if you got it stuck in the barrel, woe betide you. But we didn't get that.
What about firing it?
On the ranges, yeah. For firing, yeah.
So how much of that did you do?
Quite a bit of it, in actual fact. In the first, after one had done one's initial training, with the rifle, and of course with the Bren gun as well, that was another essential that we learned about.
So you fired quite a few rounds?
We did fire quite a few rounds, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
What was the instructor's opinion of the Lee Enfield? You know, what did they comment on?
Well, of course, they've been born and bred with it, you know. I mean, but then we eventually got to the smaller one. Was it the Mark 7, I think? I'm not too sure, but it was a lighter, it was a much lighter thing. The old Lee Enfield was quite heavy, but I'm not quite sure what mark it was. The Mark 7, the Mark 4 came out, and that was a lot easier to handle. The Bren stayed the same. It was, you know.
Did you do bayonet?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did they do that?
Well, there was a special place laid out for it with sacks of straw in the form of bodies. And we did the bayonet training against them.
How did you take to that?
Well, a bit strange at first, but eventually, I suppose, you took it as a matter of course.
Hand grenades, did you?
Yep. Mills grenades, yeah. Through them, yeah.
And no accidents or anything?
I didn't have any accident, no. There was one accident there where one of the chappies dropped one in the you had a pit, you see, he dropped it in there, but the officer was quick enough to pick it up, got the sled, sling it before it went. Because they were, on those, there was the practice grenade, so you had what I think a 7-second fuse on it. In action, they're usually a 4-second fuse. So he was lucky.
And machine guns, yeah?
Yeah, brain gun, yeah. We did brain gun training, yeah.
Light and heavy machine guns?
No, only the brain.
And mortars?
Nope.
Anti-tank weapons?
Not at that stage.
Right, okay, fine. So, anti-gas?
Yes, we did the gas training with the gas masks and so on. You went into a hut whereby tear gas had been sprayed around, and then of course you went in, and then you had to take the gas mask off and come back to see what, to let you know what the effect was like. That was it.
Was that frightening?
It wasn't very comfortable, but I suppose like all the training, you had to tuck it in your stride, you know. Shrug of the shoulder. Well, you knew darn well you couldn't say no.
Did people sort of complain about having to take the mask off or criticise the method? No.
Well, I mean, obviously, I'd comment, what the hell are we doing this for? But, I mean, apart from that, there was no great revolt.
What about tactics and field training?
Yes, we did field training on Bury St. Edmunds Golf Course, yes.
What were they teaching?
Well, teaching how you had to keep down and camouflage and, you know, leaves and branches and that sort of thing to camouflage yourself, you know. And how to keep near the ground when you're crawling along, yeah.
And what about tactics?
No tactics were taught at that, no.
Did they sort of include trench and open warfare in this?
No, it was mainly trench warfare and also how to dig trenches and things like that. Yeah, we're taught that with that absolutely useless trench tool that they issued.
What was that like?
Well, it had a very short handle on it and a spike on one side and a spade type thing on the other. But if you were on hard ground, hard luck, you know, it was absolutely useless.
Did you do any exercises or manoeuvres while on basic training?
Not on basic training, no.
Right. Did you have any sort of contact with other units arms or anything?
No.
On your own, yeah.
On our own.
Did you do any special training, like signals or scouting? Or?
No. Not there, not in the initial training.
Cooking, Batman, or?
No.
Any educational courses at all?
Nope.
Right, okay, no first aid or?
Nope.
So when you'd finished your basic training at the end of 6 weeks,
what happened? Well, in the 6th week, you went up before a board who then decided on your background and how you'd got on your training as to what unit you should go to. And you were interviewed individually. It was decided that I wanted to go to the Royal Army Service Corps. But they said, well, the officer interviewing said, well, he said, you realise that the casualties in the Royal Army Service Corps are far heavier than any other branch of the Army, which I found very difficult to accept. So we're putting you into the Armoured Corps. And so that was it.
So what sort of things did he ask you?
I think it was all based on these tests they had beforehand of what we used to say, how not to put square pegs in round holes. There were all sorts of strange things that these psychiatric tests were, one just put down whatever one thought and that was it. And as a result of those answers and how one did on the course, they were supposed to decide which arm branch of the army you're going into. I went into the Royal Armoured Corps and then went to Barrard Castle,
Were you aggrieved at being put in the Armoured Corps?
Into the
Armoured Corps?
I wasn't bothered, not really. No.
So you went to Barnard Castle?
Went to the place of higher Barford, outside of Barnard Castle, to the 59th Training Regiment, the Royal Armoured Corps, which was an armoured car training regiment. There were tank training regiments there in the area, in other camps, but we were armoured car personnel.
Was that a different sort of atmosphere?
Totally. Totally different atmosphere. It was bigger. It was a regiment, a complete regiment all on its own, yeah. Colonel Runciman, I remember, was the governor. And, of course, we each had a... instead of being... In the infantry, you're in companies and platoons. In cavalry, which we obviously were armoured, of course, you're in regiments, squadrons, and troops. So from being a private, I became a trooper. And we had... who was our squadron? Our squadron commander was a Major Quayle. Remarkable old fella.
What was he like then?
Oh, very old. Very old. And obviously regular. Very meticulous. Very meticulous, yeah.
He'd fought in the First War, hadn't
he? I presume so. I didn't actually... I would imagine he had, actually, yeah.
What did you think of him?
We regard him as a very pompous old so-and-so, yeah. And he was a pompous old so-and-so, yeah. Yeah.
So what was your sergeant would be? The daily contact with you?
Well, we had the troop, and we had our own troop hut. And then, two of us were made up to local only, provisionally unpaid acting lance corporals. Now, this was done because, as a result of my interview at the training unit, that, and the other fact that I'd been to university, that I was singled out to go on a War Office selection board at Catterick. So anybody in that category was automatically made up as soon as you got there.
So you went off to Catterick, did you?
Not right away, but... they were having these every... It took about... I think you were away for about a week to these boards. But...
So what did you do at the board? What did they get you up to?
All sorts of odd and ridiculous things. And once again, all this business of putting square pegs in round holes, all these, what I used to call stupid things. And then you get this business of whereby you were in a room. The bunch of you, perhaps about... I think about 8 or 9 of us. And they put photographs up on the screen. And you had to write down your immediate reaction. Actually, well, I couldn't see
the photographs.
Well, they put up an armoured car. And then it would go. Yeah. First thing in your mind, you put down. Then there was somebody on the end of a hangman's noose. They'd flash that on. And you'd have to...
Do you remember what you put?
No.
So they were testing
strangest attitudes, yeah. Then we also, I mean, in addition to that, one went out to do field work, whereby they would... You have what they call one officer, usually a captain or an MTO, a military testing officer. And he would put you into all sorts of situations, and you'd then work out how to get out of it. You were in a village... And your Germans were coming in, and you were about to be attacked. How do you set about defending it? Things like that.
So, a whole week of tests.
It was 3 or 4 days. I can't remember how long it was actually, but 3 or 4 days. And then we used to go. There's an assault course there where you had to get a telegraph pole. The 8 of you, a telegraph pole. Right. Well, they said, well, during none of that, I in actual fact pulled a very bad stomach muscle because I was left holding the telegraph pole all on my own while the others scrambled over, and it pulled a muscle, and I had to, from then I had to pull out. I had to have just rest, not treatment. And I was then returned to my unit, and I had to go before the adjutant the following week, who said, "I'm awfully sorry, but I've some disappointing news. You've not been accepted."
I'll stop you there. That's Norman Mitchell, the end of reel one.